Disc 9.
103. Late afternoon, Scarpetta sits 15 rows back, her legs cramped. On her left, a young boy, blonde and cute, with braces on his teeth, despondently draws Yu-Gi-Oh cards from a stack on his tray. On her right, an obese man, probably in his 50s, drinks screwdrivers next to the window. He is constantly pushing up wire-rimmed glasses, the oversized, curved frames that remind Scarpetta of Elvis. The obese man noisily flips through the Wall Street Journal and periodically glances at Scarpetta, obviously hoping to engage her in conversation. She continues to ignore him. The boy draws another Yu-Gi-Oh card and places it face up on the tray. "Who's winning?" Scarpetta asks him with a smile.
"I don't have anybody to duel with," the boy replies without looking up.
He is probably 10 and is dressed in jeans, a faded Spider-Man shirt, and tennis shoes.
"You have to have at least 40 cards to play," he adds.
"I'm afraid I'm disqualified, then." He picks up a card, a colorful one with a menacing axe on it.
"See," he says, "this one's my favorite, the Axe of Despair. It's a good weapon for a monster to have, worth 1,000 points.
He picks another card, this one called the Axe Raider.
"A very strong monster with the axe," he explains.
She studies the cards and shakes her head.
"Sorry,
too complicated for me."
"You want to learn how to play?"
"I couldn't possibly," she replies.
"What's your name?"
"Albert." He draws more cards from the deck.
"Not Al,"
he lets her know.
"Everybody thinks they can call me Al, but it's Albert."
"Nice to meet you, Albert." She does not offer her name. Scarpetta's seatmate next to the window shifts around to face her, his shoulder pressing against her upper arm.
"You don't sound like you're from Louisiana," he says.
"I'm not," she replies, leaning away from him. Her sinuses assaulted by the overpowering cologne he must have splashed on when he uprooted her to go to the restroom.
"Don't have to tell me that. One or two spoken words and I know."
He sips his vodka and orange juice.
"Let me guess. Not Texas, either. You don't exactly look Mexican," he grins.
She resumes reading a structural biology article in Science magazine and wonders when the man will get the not-so-subtle message to leave her alone. Rarely is Scarpetta accessible to strangers. If she is, then usually within 2 minutes they ask where she's going and why and wander into the restricted airspace of her profession. Telling them she's a doctor doesn't stop the quizzing, nor does saying that she's a lawyer, and should she let on that she is both, the consequences are bad enough. But to go on and explain that she is a forensic pathologist will mean the ruination of her trip. Next, JonBenet Ramsey, O.J. Simpson, and other mysterious cases and miscarriages of justice bubble up, and Scarpetta is trapped, buckled in her seat at an altitude of some 30,000 feet. Then there are those strangers who don't care if she works, but would rather see her later for dinner, or preferably for a drink in a hotel bar that might lead to a hotel room. They, like the tipsy slob sitting to her right, would rather stare at her body than hear about her resume.
"Looks like a mighty complicated article you're reading," he says. "I'm guessing you're some sort of school teacher."
She doesn't respond.
"You see, I'm good at this."
He squints his eyes and snaps his thick fingers, pointing at her face.
"A biology teacher. Kids are worthless these days."
He lifts his drink from his tray and rattles the ice in the plastic cup.
"I don't know how you stand being around them, to tell the truth,"
he goes on, apparently having decided she is a teacher.
"Plus they don't think twice about bringing a gun to school."
She feels his puffy eyes on her as she continues to read.
"You got children? I got 3. Teenagers, all of them. Obviously I got married when I was 12.
He laughs, and flecks of spittle spray through the air.
"How about I get your card from you, in case I need a little tutoring while both of us are in Baton Rouge? You changing planes, or going there? I live in the downtown area. The name's Weldon Wynne, with 2 N's. Good name for a politician, huh? Guess you can imagine the campaign slogans if I ever run for office."
"When are we landing?" Albert asks her. She looks at her watch and forces a smile as the name Weldon Wynne shocks her. "Not too much longer,"
she says to the boy.
Yes, ma'am, I can just imagine signs all over Louisiana. It's win-win with win, get it? And go with the winner. Maybe I'll be lucky and have an opponent named Miracle, so win needs no miracle. How about that? And when Mr. Miracle slides hopelessly downhill in the polls, he'll be called Miracle Whipped.
He winks again. I suppose there's no chance you might run against a she, Scarpetta comments, without looking up from her magazine, pretending she doesn't have a clue that Weldon Wynne is the Middle District U.S. Attorney for Louisiana that Nick Robillard complained about.
Hell, no woman would take me on.
I see. So what kind of politician are you? Scarpetta finally asks him.
One in spirit only at the moment, pretty lady. I'm the U.S. Attorney for Baton Rouge.
He pauses to let the importance of his position sink in, finishing his screwdriver and craning his neck in search of a flight attendant. Spotting one, he holds up an arm and snaps his fingers at her. It can't be chance that Weldon Wynne just happens to be sitting next to her on a plane when she just happens to be on her way to assist in a suspicious death that, according to Dr. Lanier, just happens to have captured Weldon Wynne's interest after she just happens to have left Jean-Baptiste Chandon. She tries to figure out how Wynne would have had time to intercept her in Houston. Maybe he was already there. She has no doubt whatsoever that he knows who she is and why she's on this flight.
Got a getaway in New Orleans, quite a cozy little palace in the French Quarter. Maybe you can visit while you're in the area. I'll be around for just a couple nights, got business with the governor and a few of the boys. I'd be more than happy to give you a personal tour of the Capitol, show you the bullet hole in a pillar where Huey Long was shot.
Scarpetta knows all about the notorious Huey Long's assassination. When the case was reopened in the early 90s, the results of the new investigation were discussed at various Forensic Science Academy meetings. She's had enough of the pompous Weldon Wynne. For your own edification, she tells him, the so-called bullet hole in the marble pillar was not caused by a bullet intended for Huey Long or anyone else, but more likely from an imperfection in the stone, or a chiseled facsimile of a bullet hole to attract tourism. As a matter of fact, she adds, as Wynne's eyes flatten and his smile freezes, since the assassination the Capitol was restored and that particular pillar's marble panels were removed and never returned to their original location. I'm surprised you spend a lot of time at the state capitol and don't know all this, she concludes.
My aunt's supposed to pick me up, and if I'm late, what if she isn't there?
Albert asks Scarpetta, as if the two of them are traveling together. He has lost interest in his trading cards, which are neatly stacked next to a blue cell phone.
Do you know what time it is? He says.
Almost 6, Scarpetta says. If you're sleepy, take a little nap and I'll let you know when we're about to land.
I'm not sleepy.
She recalls noticing him at the gate in Houston, playing with his cards. Because he was sitting next to other adults, she assumed he was accompanied, and that his family or whoever he is traveling with were seated elsewhere on the plane. It never occurred to her that any parent or relative would allow a young child to travel alone, especially these days.
Now, isn't that something? Not too many people are experts on bullet holes,
the U.S. attorney comments as the flight attendant serves him another drink. No, I don't suppose too many people are. Scarpetta's attention is focused on the lost little boy next to her. You aren't by yourself, are you? She asks him.
And why aren't you in school? It's spring break. Uncle Walt dropped me off and a lady at the airport met me. I'm not tired. Sometimes I get to stay up really late watching movies. We get 1,000 channels.
He pauses and shrugs.
Well, maybe not that many, but a lot. Do you have any pets? I used to have a dog named Nestle because it was brown like chocolate chips.
Let's see, Scarpetta says. I don't have a dog the color of chocolate, but I have an English bulldog who's white and brown with very big lower teeth. His name is Billy.
Do you know what an English bulldog is? Like a pit bull?
Not anything like a pit bull. Weldon Wynne butts into the conversation.
Might I ask where you're staying while you're in town?
Nestle used to miss me when I wasn't home, Albert wistfully says.
I'm sure he did, Scarpetta replies. I think Billy misses me, too. But my secretary takes good care of him.
Nestle was a girl.
What happened to her?
I don't know.
My, my, if you want a mysterious little lady,
the U.S. attorney says, staring at her. Scarpetta turns to him, catching a cold glint in his eyes. She leans close to him and whispers in his ear, I've had enough of your bullshit.
104. The Learjet 35 belongs to Homeland Security, and Benton is the only passenger on it. Landing at Louisiana Air in Baton Rouge, he hurries down the steps, carrying a soft-sided bag, not looking at all like the Benton his people once knew. Facial hair, a black Super Bowl baseball cap, and tinted glasses. His black suit is off the rack from Saks, where he blitzed through the men's department yesterday. Shoes are Prada, black, rubber soles. His belt is also Prada, and he wears a black T-shirt. None of the clothes, except the shoes and T-shirt, are a perfect fit. But he hasn't owned a suit in years, and it did cross his mind in the dressing room that he missed the soft new wools, cashmere, and polished cotton of the past, when tailors made chalk marks on sleeves and cuffs that needed to be hemmed. He wonders who Scarpetta gave his expensive clothes to after his alleged death. Knowing her as well as he does, aware of her great powers of denial, he suspects that either she didn't clean out his closets at all and had someone else do it, or she was assisted, possibly by Lucy, who would have had an easier time disposing of his personal effects, since she knew he wasn't dead. Then again, it depends on how much of an actress Lucy felt she should or could be at the time. Pain crushes him, as for an instant he feels Scarpetta's pain, imagines the unimaginable, her grief, and how poorly she probably handled it. Stop. A waste of time and mental energy to speculate. Idle thoughts. Focus. As he walks briskly across the tarmac, he notices a Bell 407 helicopter, dark blue or black, with pop-out floats, a wire strike, and bold, bright stripes. He notices the tail number, 407 TLP, the last precinct. A flight from New York to Baton Rouge is about 1,000 miles. Depending on the winds and fuel stops, she could have made it here in 10 hours if she was unlucky with a headwind, and much less time than that with a tailwind. In either scenario, if she left early this morning, she should have gotten here by late afternoon. He contemplates what she's been doing since, and wonders whether Marino is with her. Benton's car is a dark red Jaguar, rented in New Orleans and delivered here to the parking lot, one of the privileges for those who fly private. At the front of the FBO, as small private airports with only a Unicom are called, he speaks to a young lady. Behind her is a monitor showing the status of other incoming flights. There are few, his listed with the update that it has just landed. Lucy's helicopter isn't on the screen, indicating she arrived some time ago.
I have a rental car that should be here.
Benton knows it will be. The senator will have made sure that all details have been handled. The clerk looks through rental car folders. Benton catches the news and turns around to observe pilots watching CNN in a small corner lounge. On the screen is an old photograph of Jean-Baptiste Chandon. Benton isn't surprised. Chandon escaped early this afternoon after disguising himself as one of the two corrections officers he killed.
God, talk about an ugly bastard, one of the pilots comments. You gotta be kidding me. No human being looks like that.
The photograph is a mugshot taken in Richmond, Virginia, where Chandon was arrested 3 years ago. He was not clean-shaven at the time, and his face, even his forehead, was horrifically covered with baby-fine hair. Showing the old photograph is a shame. Chandon could not have escaped from prison unless he is clean-shaven. When he is hairy, he is a conspicuous freak. For the public to see this old mugshot isn't helpful, especially if he wears caps or sunglasses or employs other means of disguising his grotesquely deformed face. The clerk is frozen behind the desk, staring with her mouth open at the TV across the room.
If I saw him, I'd die of a heart attack, she exclaims. Is he for real, or is that weirdo hair fake and everything?
Benton glances at his watch, the successful businessman in a hurry. His protective law enforcement instincts, however, are impossible to suppress.
He's real, I'm afraid, he tells the clerk. I remember hearing about his murders a few years back. I guess we'd better be on the lookout with him on the loose.
You can say that again.
She hands him the rental envelope.
I guess I need to run your charge card.
He pulls a platinum American Express card out of his wallet, which also holds $2,000, mostly in $100 bills. More cash is tucked in various pockets. Not knowing how long he'll be here, he has come prepared. He initials the rental car form and signs it.
Thank you, Mr. Andrews. Drive carefully, the clerk says, with a bright smile that goes with the job. And I hope you enjoy your stay in Baton Rouge.
105. Scarpetta's tension mounts as she and Albert watch baggage go by on the carousel inside Baton Rouge's main terminal. The time is almost 7 p.m., and she is beginning to entertain real worries that no one has come to meet him. He collects one suitcase and clings to Scarpetta's side as she reclaims her own bag.
"Looks like you found yourself a new friend."
Weldon Wynne is suddenly behind her. "Come on," she says to Albert. They walk through automatic glass doors. "I'm sure your aunt will drive up any minute. She's probably having to circle because cars aren't allowed to park at the curb." Armed soldiers in camouflage patrol inside the baggage area and outside on the sidewalk. Albert seems oblivious to the unsmiling military presence, to their fingers resting on the trigger guards of assault rifles. His face is bright red.
"You and me are going to talk, Dr. Scarpetta," U.S. Attorney Wynne finally says her name and dares to wrap an arm around her shoulder.
"I think it would be a very good idea for you to keep your hands off me," she quietly warns him.
He removes an arm.
"And I think it might be a good idea for you to learn how things are done down here."
He watches cars pull up to the curb.
"We're going to meet, all right. Any information about ongoing investigations is important. And if someone's an informant..."
"I am no informant," she interrupts his outrageous intimation that if she doesn't fully cooperate with him, he'll subpoena her for deposition.
"Who told you I was coming to Baton Rouge?" Albert begins to cry.
"Let me let you in on a little secret, pretty lady. Nothing much happens around here that I don't know about."
"Mr. Wynne," she says, "if you have a legitimate need to talk to me at some point, I'll be happy to do so. But in an appropriate venue, which a sidewalk outside an airport clearly isn't."
"And I'll certainly look forward to that."
He holds up a hand and snaps his fingers, signaling his driver. She slings her bag over her shoulder and takes Albert's hand.
"Don't worry. It's all right," she tells him. "I'm sure your aunt's on her way. But if she's been delayed for some reason, I'm not going to leave you all by yourself, okay?"
"But I don't know you. I'm not supposed to go anywhere with strangers," he whines.
"We sat together on the plane, didn't we?" she replies, as Weldon Wynne's white stretch limousine pulls up to the curb. "So you know me a little bit, and I promise you're safe, perfectly safe."
Wynne climbs into the back seat and shuts the door, disappearing behind dark-tinted glass. Cars and taxis stop for pickups, trunks popping open. People hug loved ones. Albert's wide, runny eyes dart around furtively, his fears quickly broaching hysteria. Scarpetta senses Wynne looking out at her as the limousine drives off, and her thoughts are scattered like marbles dashed to the floor. It is hard for her to sort through what she should do next, but she starts with dialing directory assistance on her cell phone and finds out in short order that there is no listing for a Weldon Wynne, or anyone with the last name of Wynne in New Orleans, where he claims to have a place in the French Quarter. His number in Baton Rouge is unlisted. "Why am I not surprised?" she mutters, and all she can suppose is that someone told the U.S. attorney she was arriving here in the early evening, and he flew to Houston and made sure he was on her connecting flight and seated next to her. Added to that disturbing and enigmatic development is her responsibility for a child she doesn't know, whose family seems to have abandoned him. "You have your aunt's phone number, don't you?" she says to Albert. "Come on, let's call her. And by the way," it occurs to her, "you haven't told me your last name."
"Dard," Albert says. "I have my own cell phone, but the battery's dead."
"I beg your pardon. What did you say your last name is?"
"Dard."
He hunches a shoulder to wipe his face.
106.
Albert Dard stares down at the dirty sidewalk, focusing on dried gum, gray and shaped like a small cookie.
"Why were you in Houston?" Scarpetta asks him.
"To change planes,"
he begins to sob.
"But where were you first? Where did you leave from?"
"Miami,"
he replies, increasingly distraught.
"I was with my uncle for spring break, and then my aunt said I had to come home right away."
"Why did she say that?"
Having given up on his aunt, Scarpetta takes Albert's hand, and they walk back inside the baggage area, headed for the Hertz rental car desk.
"This morning," he replies, "I think I did something bad. Uncle Walt walked into my bedroom and woke me up. He said I was going home. I was supposed to be with him another 3 days."
Scarpetta squats and looks him in the eyes, gently holding his shoulders.
"Albert, where's your mother?"
He bites his bottom lip.
"With the angels," he says. "My aunt says they're all around us all the time. I've never seen even one."
"And your father?"
"Away. He's very important."
"Tell me your home phone number and let's find out what's going on," she says. "Or maybe you have your aunt's cell number. And what is her name?"
Albert tells her his aunt's name and his home number. Scarpetta calls. After several rings, a woman answers.
"Is Mrs. Guidon in, please?" Scarpetta asks as Albert holds her hand tightly.
"May I ask who's calling?"
The woman is polite, her accent French.
"I'm not someone she knows, but I'm with her nephew Albert, at the airport. It appears there is no one to pick him up."
She hands the phone to Albert.
"Here," she says to him.
"Who is it?"
he asks oddly. After a pause, he says,
"Because you're not here, that's why. I don't know her name."
He scowls, his tone snippy. Scarpetta does not volunteer her name to him. Albert lets go of her hand and balls up his fist. He begins smacking it against his thigh, punching himself. The woman talks fast, her voice audible but unintelligible. She and Albert are speaking French, and Scarpetta stares at Albert with renewed bewilderment as he angrily ends the call and returns the cell phone to her.
"Where did you learn French?" she asks him.
"My mom," he gloomily says. "Aunt Eveline makes me talk it a lot."
Tears fill his eyes again.
"I tell you what, let's get my rental car and I'll take you home. You can show me where you live, can't you?"
He wipes his eyes and nods his head. 107. Baton Rouge is a skyline of black smokestacks of different heights, and a pearly smog hangs in a band across the dark horizon. In the distance, the night is illuminated by the blazing lights of petrochemical plants. Albert Dard's mood is improving as his new friend drives along River Road, not far from LSU's football stadium. Along a graceful bend in the Mississippi, he points to iron gates and old brick pillars up ahead.
"There," he says. "That's it."
Where he lives is an estate set back at least a quarter of a mile from the road, a massive slate roof and several chimneys rising above dense trees. Scarpetta stops the car and Albert gets out to enter a code on a keypad, and the gates slowly open. They drive slowly to the classical Revival villa with its small wavy glass windows and massive masonry front porch. Old live oak trees bend over the property as if to protect it. The only car visible is an old white Volvo parked in front on the cobblestone drive.
"Is your father home?" Scarpetta asks as her silver rental Lincoln bumps over pavers.
"No,"
Albert glumly replies as they park. They get out and climb steep brick steps. Albert unlocks the door and deactivates the burglar alarm, and they enter a restored antebellum home with hand-carved molding, dark mahogany, painted panels, and antique oriental rugs that are threadbare and dreary. Wan light filters through windows flanked by heavy damask draperies held back with tasseled cords, and a staircase winds up to a second floor, where someone's quick footsteps sound against a wooden floor.
"That's my aunt," Albert says, as a woman with bones like a bird's and unsmiling dark eyes descends the stairs, her hand gliding along the smooth, gleaming wooden banister.
"I am Mrs. Guidon."
She walks with light, quick steps to the entrance hallway. With her sensuous mouth and delicate nostrils, Mrs. Guidon would be pretty were her face not hard and her dress so severe. A high collar is fastened with a gold brooch, and she wears a long black skirt and clumsy lace-up black shoes, and her black hair is tightly pinned back. She appears to be in her 40s, but her age is hard to determine. Her skin is unlined and so pale it is almost translucent, as if she has never seen the sun.
"May I offer you a cup of tea?"
Mrs. Guidon's smile is as chilly as the stale, still air.
"Yes," Albert grabs Scarpetta's hand. "Please come have tea, and cookies, too. You're my new friend."
"There will be no tea for you," Mrs. Guidon tells him. "Go up to your room right this minute. Take your suitcase with you. I will let you know when you can come down."
"Don't leave," Albert begs Scarpetta. "I hate you," he says to Mrs. Guidon.
She ignores him, obviously having heard this before.
"Such a funny little boy who is very tired and cranky because it is very late. Now say goodbye. I'm afraid you won't see this nice lady again."
Scarpetta is kind to him as she says goodbye. He trudges angrily up the stairs, looking back at her several times, his face painfully touching her heart. When she hears his footsteps on the wooden floor upstairs, she looks hard at her unpleasant and peculiar hostess.
"How cold you are to a little boy, Mrs. Guidon," she says. "What kind of people are you and his father that you would hope a stranger would bring him home?"
"I am disappointed."
Her imperious demeanor doesn't waver.
"I thought a scientist of your renown would investigate before making assumptions."
108. Lucy and Marino connect by cell phone. "Where's she staying?" she asks from her parked black Lincoln Navigator SUV. She and Rudy figured out that the best way to be inconspicuous was to pull into the Radisson parking lot and sit with the engine and lights off.
"The coroner. I'm glad she ain't by herself in no hotel."
"None of us need to be in a hotel," Lucy says.
"Damn, could you drive a louder truck?"
"If I had one."
"How does he check out? What's his name?"
"Sam Lanier. His background's clean as a whistle. When he called to check out the doc, I got the impression he's an okay guy."
"Well, if he isn't, she'll be all right. Because he's about to have three other house guests," Lucy says.
109.
A fragile Wedgwood teacup lightly clinks against a saucer. Mrs. Guidon and Scarpetta sit at a kitchen table made of a centuries-old butcher block that Scarpetta finds repulsive. She can't help but imagine how many chickens and other animals were slaughtered and chopped up on the worn, sloping wood with its hack marks, cracks, and discoloration. It is an unpleasant byproduct of her profession that she knows too much, and it is almost impossible to kill bacteria on porous materials such as wood. "How many times must I demand to know why I'm here, and how you managed to get me here?" Scarpetta's eyes are intense.
"I find it charming that Albert seems to have decided you are his friend," Mrs. Guidon remarks. "I try very hard to encourage him. He wants nothing to do with school sports or any other activities that might expose him to children his own age. He thinks he belongs right here at this table."
She taps the butcher block with her small, milky white knuckles. "Talking to you and me as if he is our peer." After years of dealing with people who refuse to answer questions, or can't, or are in denial, Scarpetta is skilled at catching truths as they subtly show themselves. "Why doesn't he associate with children his own age?" she inquires.
"Who knows? It is a mystery. He has always been odd, really, preferring to stay home and do homework, entertaining himself with those peculiar games children play these days. Cards with those awful creatures on them. Cards and computers, cards and more cards."
Her gestures are dramatic, her French accent heavy, her English stilted and faltering.
"He has been more this way as he gets older, isolated and playing the card games. Often he is home, stays in his room with the door shut, and will not come out."
Suddenly she softens and seems caring. Every detail Scarpetta observes is conflicting and disturbing, the kitchen an argument of anachronisms that seem a metaphor for this house and the people who live in it. Behind her is a cavernous fireplace, with formidable hand-forged andirons capable of bearing a load of wood large enough to heat up a room 3 times this size. A door leads outside, and next to it is a complicated alarm system keypad and an A-phone with a video screen for the cameras that no doubt guard every entrance. Another keypad, this one much larger, indicates the old mansion is a smart house with multiple modems that allow the occupants to remotely control heating, cooling, lights, entertainment centers, and gas fireplaces, and even turn appliances off and on. Yet the appliances and thermostats Scarpetta has seen so far have not been upgraded for what she estimates is at least 30 years. A knife holder on the granite countertop is empty, and there are no knives in the porcelain sink, not a knife anywhere in sight. Yet hanging over the fireplace is a rack of 19th-century swords, and on the heavy chestnut mantel is a revolver with rubber grips, most likely a .38 in a black leather holster. Mrs. Guidon follows Scarpetta's eyes, and for an instant her face registers anger. She has made an oversight, a telling mistake. Leaving the revolver in plain view was not intentional.
"I'm sure it hasn't escaped your notice that Mr. Dodd is very security-conscious."
She sighs, shrugging, as if taking her guest into her confidence and hinting that Mr. Dard is ridiculously cautious and paranoid.
"Baton Rouge is high crime. I'm sure you know that. Living in a house like this and having wealth causes concerns, although I'm not the type to be looking over my shoulder all the time."
Scarpetta hides how much she dislikes Mrs. Guidon and is infuriated about what Albert's life must be like. She wonders how far she can go to pry loose the secrets that haunt this very old estate.
"Albert seems very unhappy and misses his dog," she says. "Perhaps you should get him another one, especially if he's lonely and has no friends."
"With him, I believe it is genetics. His mother, my sister, wasn't well."
Mrs. Guidon pauses, then adds,
"Of course you know that."
"Why don't you tell me what I'm supposed to know? You seem to know so much about me."
"Now you are perceptive,"
Mrs. Guidon replies with a touch of condescension,
"but not as cautious as I would have guessed. Albert called me on your cell phone, remember? That was careless for someone of your reputation."
"What do you know of my reputation?"
"Caller ID came back to your name, and I am aware you haven't suddenly arrived in Baton Rouge for a little vacation. Charlotte's case is complicated. No one seems to have any idea what happened to her, or why she went to a horrible motel frequented by truck drivers and the dregs of society. So Dr. Lanier has solicited your assistance, no? But I at least am relieved and grateful. And let's just say it was planned that you would sit next to Albert and drive him home, and here you are."
She lifts her teacup.
"All things happen for a reason, as you must know."
"How could you possibly have orchestrated all this?"
Scarpetta pushes her, warns her, making it clear that she has had enough.
"I don't suppose U.S. Attorney Weldon Wynne is involved with your scheming, since he just happened to sit next to me, too."
"There is much you don't know. Mr. Wynne is a close family friend."
"What family? Albert's father didn't show up at the airport. Albert doesn't seem to even know where he is. What did any of you suppose would happen to a young boy traveling alone?"
"He wasn't alone. He was with you, and now you are here. I wanted to meet you. Perfect."
"Family friend?" Scarpetta repeats. "Then why did Albert not know Weldon Wynne if he is such a good family friend?"
"Albert has never met him."
"That makes no sense. That's not for you to say."
"I'll say whatever I want. Since you seem to have assigned Albert to me and were certain he would be safe with me, a perfect stranger, and that I would bring him home. How could you be sure I would take it upon myself to look after him, or that I'm trustworthy?"
Scarpetta pushes back her chair and gets up, and it scrapes loudly against heart-of-pine flooring.
"He lost his mother, who the hell knows about the father, and he's lost his dog, and next he's abandoned and frightened. In my business, this is called child neglect, child abuse."
Her anger flashes.
"I am Charlotte's sister."
Mrs. Guidon gets up, too.
"All you've done is manipulate me, or try to. I'm leaving now."
"Please let me show you around first," Mrs. Guidon says. "Particularly Le Cave."
How could you possibly have a wine cellar in an area where the water table is so high that plantation houses have to be built on pillars? Scarpetta asks.
So you are not always observant? This house is on an elevation, built in 1793. The original owner found the perfect location for what he had in mind. He was a Frenchman, a wine connoisseur who often travelled back to France. Slaves constructed a wine cellar like the ones he knew in France, and I doubt there is another one like it in this country.
She walks to the door leading outside and opens it.
You simply must see it. Baton Rouge's best-kept secret.
Scarpetta stands where she is.
No.
Mrs. Guidon lowers her voice and is almost gentle when she explains.
You are wrong about Albert. I was circling the airport. I saw the two of you on the sidewalk. Had you left him, I would have picked him up. But based on what I know about you, you would not leave him. You are too caring, too decent, and you are wary about the evils in this world.
She states this not with feeling, but as fact. How could you have been circling the airport? I called you at home, programmed to roll over to my cell phone. I actually was looking at you when you called me. This amuses her.
I go to the house no more than 15 minutes before you did, Dr. Scarpetta. I don't blame you for being angry and confused, but I wanted to talk to you when Jason wasn't here, Albert's father. Believe me, you are very fortunate that he isn't here.
She hesitates, holding the kitchen door open wide.
When he's around, there is no such thing as privacy. Please, come.
She motions to her. Scarpetta looks at the keypads by the kitchen door. Outside, shadows fall in a black curtain from trees lush with new leaves. The woods are damp and earthy beneath a waning moon.
I will let you out this way, then. The driveway is just to the side. But you must promise to come back and see the cave, she says.
I'll go out the front. Scarpetta starts walking that way. 110. Benton drove around for a while, then checked into the Radisson under the assumed name of Tony Wilson. Inside his suite, he sits on the bed, his door secured with the deadbolt lock and burglar chain. He requested a block on his telephone, not that he is expecting calls. The clerks at reception seem to understand. He is a wealthy man from Los Angeles and wants privacy. The hotel is the finest one in Baton Rouge, its staff accustomed to accommodating a lot of people from all over who don't use the valets, preferring to come and go discreetly. They don't want to be bothered and rarely stay long. Benton connects his laptop to the modem line in his room. He enters his code to release the lock of the new black briefcase he deliberately scuffed by scraping it against furniture and sliding it across the floor. He takes off his ankle holster and places his .357 Magnum Smith & Wesson 340 PD on the bed. It is double action, loaded with 5 rounds of Speer Gold Dot 125 grain. From the briefcase he removes 2 pistols, a pocket-friendly .40 caliber Glock 27, capacity 10 rounds, including 1 in the chamber. The ammunition is Hydroshock, 135 grain, center post hollow point with a notched jacket, velocity 1,190 feet per second, high energy and with efficient stopping power, punches into the enemy and splays like a razor-sharp flower. His second and most important pistol is the P226 SL Sig Sauer 9mm, capacity 16 rounds, including 1 in the chamber. The ammunition is also Hydroshock, 125 grain, center post hollow point with notch jacket, velocity 1,120 feet per second, deep penetration and stopping power. It is conceivable he can carry the 3 guns at once. He's done it before. The .357 Smith & Wesson in his ankle holster, the .40 caliber Glock in a shoulder holster, and the 9mm Sig Sauer in the waistband at the small of his back. Extra magazines for the pistols and extra cartridges for the .357 Magnum go in a designer leather butt pack. Benton dresses in a loose-fitting London fog jacket and baggy jeans that are slightly too long, a cap, tinted glasses, and the rubber-soled Prada shoes. He could be a tourist. He could work in Baton Rouge and barely merit notice in this city of transients, where hundreds of professors, some of them eccentric, and thousands of oblivious students and preoccupied visiting scholars of all ages and nationalities abound. He could be straight. He could be gay. He could be both.
111. The next morning, muddy, sluggish water carries Scarpetta's eye to a riverboat casino, to the USS Kidd battleship, and on to the distant old Mississippi Bridge, then back to Dr. Sam Lanier. In the few minutes she spent with him last night, when she finally arrived at his door and he quickly escorted her to his guest house in back, without walking her through the main house because he didn't want to awaken his wife, she decided she liked him. She worries that she shouldn't. In Charlotte Dard's case, she says, how involved did you and your office get with the family in terms of trying to counsel or question them?
Not as much as I would have liked. I tried.
The light in his eyes dims, and his mouth tightens.
I did talk to the sister, Mrs. Guidon.
Briefly.
She's an odd one.
Anyway, orientation time. Let me show you where you are. His abrupt change of subject strikes her as paranoid, as if he worries that someone might be listening. Swiveling around in his chair, he points west, out the window.
People are always jumping from the old Mississippi Bridge. Can't tell you how many times I've fished bodies out of the river because some poor soul takes a leap. Takes his time, too, while the police try to talk him down, and people in their cars start yelling, "Go ahead and jump," because he's slowing up traffic. Can you believe that? Now, down there, straight ahead, I had a guy dressed in a shower curtain with an AK-47 tried to get on the USS Kidd to kill all the Russians. He got intercepted, he drolly adds. Death and mental health are part of the same department, and we do all the pickups. Commit about 3,000 cases a year.
And that works how, exactly? Scarpetta inquires. A family member requests an order of protective custody?
Almost always. But the police can request it. And if the coroner, in this case me, believes the person is gravely disabled and acutely dangerous to himself or others and is unwilling or unable to seek medical attention, deputies are sent in.
The coroner is elected. It helps if he's on good terms with the mayor, the police, the sheriff, LSU, Southern University, the district attorney, judges, the U.S. attorney, not to mention influential members of the community. She pauses. People in power can certainly influence the public on how to cast its votes. So the police recommend someone should be removed to a psychiatric hospital, and the local coroner agrees. In my world, that's called a conflict of interest.
It's worse than that. The coroner also determines competency to stand trial.
So you oversee the autopsy of a murder victim, determine cause and manner of death. Then if the alleged killer is caught, you decide if he's competent to stand trial.
Do the DNA swab in the exam room. Then sits right here in my office, a cop on either side, attorney present, and I interview him or her.
Dr. Lanier, you have the most bizarre coroner system I've ever heard of, and it doesn't sound to me as if you have any protection should the powers that be decide they can't control you.
Welcome to Louisiana. And if the powers that be try to tell me how to do my job, I tell them to kiss my ass.
And your crime rate? I know it's bad.
Worse than bad. Terrible, he replies. By far, Baton Rouge has the highest rate of unsolved homicides in the entire country.
Why?
Clearly, Baton Rouge is a very violent city. I'm not sure why.
And the police?
Listen, I have a lot of respect for street cops. Most of them try very hard. But then you've got the people in charge who squash the good guys and encourage the assholes. Politics.
His chair creaks as he leans back in it.
We've got a serial murderer running around down here. Have probably had more than one running around down here over the decades.
He shrugs in a manner that is anything but easygoing or accepting.
Politics. How many times do I need to say the word?
Organized crime?
Fifth largest port in the country, the second largest petrochemical industry, and Louisiana produces some 16% of the nation's oil. Come on.
He gets up from his desk.
Lunch. Everybody's got to eat, and I have a feeling you haven't done much of that lately. You look pretty damn beat up, and your suit's hanging a little loose around the waist.
Scarpetta can't begin to tell him how much she has grown to hate her black suit. Three clerks glance up as Scarpetta and Dr. Lanier walk out of his office.
"You coming back?"
An overweight woman with gray hair asks her boss, a cool steel edge to her voice. Scarpetta is fairly sure this is the clerk Dr. Lanier has complained about.
"Who knows?"
he responds in what Scarpetta would call the flat affect of an expert witness testifying in court. She can tell he doesn't like her. Old, ugly specters hover between them. He seems relieved when the outer office door opens and a tall, good-looking man in navy range pants and a dark blue coroner's jacket walks in. His presence is a high energy that is several steps ahead of him, and the overweight clerk's eyes fasten on his face like dark, angry wasps. Eric Murphy, the chief death investigator, welcomes Scarpetta to Louisiana.
"Where are we going to lunch?"
he asks.
"No matter what, you have to eat," Dr. Lanier says at the elevator. "I insist, and this is the place to do it. Like I said, I can't get rid of her."
He absently stabs the button for the parking garage.
"Hell, she's been working in this office longer than I have. Sort of an inherited sinkhole that gets passed on from one corner to the next."
The elevator doors open inside a large parking garage. Car doors shut in muffled counterpoint as people head out to lunch, and Dr. Lanier points his key at what he calls his unit, a black Chevrolet Caprice with a blue light in the dash, a two-way radio, a police scanner, and a special turbocharged V8 engine that is required for all high-speed chases, he boasts, as Scarpetta helps herself to a backseat door and slides into the seat.
"You can't be sitting in back. It doesn't look right," Eric complains, holding open the front passenger door. "You're our guest, ma'am."
"Oh, please, don't call me ma'am. I'm Kay, and my legs are shorter, which means I sit in the back."
"Call me anything you like," Eric cheerfully replies. "Everybody else does. From now on, I'm Sam. No more of this doctor shit." "Don't be calling me doctor either," Eric says, "for the good reason that I'm not one."
He gets inside the car, giving up on telling Scarpetta where to sit.
"Hell, the only time you were a doctor was when you were what?"
Dr. Lanier starts the engine.
10, maybe 12 years old and molesting all the little girls in your neighborhood? Jesus God, I hate parking between concrete damn pillars." "They have a way of moving in on you, don't they, Sam?"
Eric turns around and winks at Scarpetta.
"They grab at his vehicle on a regular basis. Look over there."
He points at a concrete support gouged and streaked with black paint.
"If you were working that crime scene, what would you conclude?"
He peels cellophane off a pack of dentine chewing gum.
"Let me give you a clue. That used to be the coroner's parking place. But not so long ago, the coroner, guess which one, and there's only one, complained it was way too narrow, and he'd be goddamned if he was parking there." "Now don't tell all my secrets."
Dr. Lanier slowly creeps out of his spot.
"Besides, it was my wife who did that bit of damage. She's a worse driver than I am, for the record." "She's a death investigator, too."
Eric turns around again.
"Works for nothing, which is pretty much what the rest of us do." "Shit."
Dr. Lanier accelerates his high-speed chase unit more than necessary inside a parking deck.
"You get paid a hell of a lot more than you deserve."
"Can we talk now?" Scarpetta asks.
"I'm pretty sure we can. Maybe people get into my office, hell if I know. But nobody touches my car. Or my Harley,"
Dr. Lanier replies. In a firm, even voice, Scarpetta confronts him. "I happened to fly here with the Dard's young son sitting on one side of me and your U.S. Attorney Weldon Wynne on the other. In fact, I ended up having to drive Albert Dard home. You want to tell me what that's about?"
"Scares the hell out of me."
"The boy just happens to be in Miami, is suddenly whisked to the airport yesterday morning and routed through Houston, and just happens to be on my flight to Baton Rouge, just as Wynne happens to be on my flight. And, by the way, you don't strike me as the sort who gets scared."
"Two things. One, you don't know me. Two, you don't know here."
"Where was Albert Dard 8 years ago when his mother died in that motel room?" Scarpetta asks. "Where was his father? And why is this mysterious father, quote, gone all the time, as the boy put it?
That I don't know. What I can tell you is I'm familiar with Albert. Last year I had to examine the kid in the ER. Was given a heads up, in other words, especially in light of his wealthy family and the mysterious death of his mother. He was committed to a private psychiatric hospital in New Orleans.
What on earth for? Scarpetta asks, adding, a psychiatric history and his family lets him travel alone?
But then he wasn't alone, according to what you've told me. His uncle put him in the hands of airline attendants, who also no doubt saw to it that he got to his proper gate in Houston. Then, best of all, you took care of him the rest of the time. He's not psychotic.
The story is, 3 years ago last October, his aunt called 911 and said her nephew, he was 7 at the time, I believe, was bleeding badly and claimed to have been assaulted when he was out riding his bicycle. Story is, he was hysterical, scared out of his mind. Well, nobody assaulted that poor little kid, Kay. You said I could call you that. There was no evidence whatsoever of that. In fact, he's a cutter, into self-mutilation. Apparently that started up again with him not long before I examined him in the ER, which was a pretty damn awful experience.
Scarpetta recalls the absence of knives in the Dard kitchen. You're absolutely certain his injuries were self-inflicted? She asks.
I try not to be absolutely certain of anything. I don't know of much that's an absolute certainty except death, Dr. Lanier replies. But I found a lot of hesitation cuts. Just scratches, really. That's significant for someone getting started in this unfortunate pattern of self-destruction. His cuts were minor, all in places within reach, but not readily visible to others. Stomach, thighs, buttocks.
That would explain why I saw no scars when I was sitting next to him on the plane, Scarpetta remarks. I would have noticed.
What really disturbs me is the obvious, he says. Somebody wants you here in Baton Rouge. Why?
You tell me. You tell me who leaked my travel plans, because it seems the most likely suspect is you, or whoever else in your office knew I was coming.
I can see why you'd think that. No question about it.
Well, tell me who leaked my travel plans, because it seems the most likely suspect is you, or whoever else in your office knew I was coming. You tell me who leaked my travel plans, because it seems the most likely suspect is you, or whoever else in your office knew I was coming.
Project proscape got a real job, managed to maddens.